I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. A little later in the program, we talk with author Marion Winnick about her book, Highs in the Low 50s, How I Stumbled Through the Joys of Single Living. Up first,
American writer E.B. White inspired generations of readers with his essays, children's literature, and stylistic guidance. In addition to his well-known and loved books, Charlotte's Web, Stuart Little, and One Man's Meat, he also was a columnist for The New Yorker for half a century. E.B. White's granddaughter, Martha White, joins us this morning to talk about E.B. White on Dogs, the book she compiled from her grandfather's essays, poems, letters, and sketches on dogs. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
I should say welcome back.
Thank you.
Safe to say your grandfather loved dogs. He owned various breeds over his lifetime. Did he have a favorite?
Well, he loved them all. And of course, he loved the current one, whichever the current one was. But he certainly had a number of dachshunds. And the dachshunds showed up probably more than any other breed in his writings, although there are also collie dogs and beagles and mixed breeds, mutts of various sizes and shapes, and many terriers. So they were all in there, and he loved them all. But the dachshunds probably shine on the paper.
A little bit more than anybody else, yeah. And he would sometimes write about serious issues using his dogs, especially Daisy and Fred, who were interviewed for his column in The New Yorker.
Right. Daisy was a Scotty dog, a very opinionated little Scotty dog. She may be the only dog, to my knowledge, who had her obituary printed in The New Yorker. She was hit by a taxi cab in New York City in front of a florist shop when the taxi cab jumped the curb. So that's in there. But she was also arrested. She was thrown out of Schraff's. She had various escapades, some of them with horses in the city. And she was interviewed. Fred was also interviewed a couple of times, particularly posthumously on the subject of dogs being sent into space,
right,
which, as you can imagine, he had a strong opinion about. So the dogs showed up as literary devices frequently.
That's something I actually jotted down here. Of course, when word that the Russian sends a dog into space, where else would you turn but to another dog to get perspective on that?
Right, right. Yeah. Fred didn't think Nikita should have been the one to be sent into space. He had strong feelings about that.
And that sort of shows the sense of fun, too, that your grandfather had to be able to kind of have us look at these different issues or situations through,
right,
through the
absolutely.
Dog.
I think he enjoyed using the dogs and also sometimes geese and other animals as literary devices, partly because they could say things that he might not otherwise have said. And one of the letters in the collection, E.B. White on Dogs, is a letter purportedly from Daisy to my grandmother to tell her how happy E.B. was at the impending birth of my father.
Yeah,
and that's a terrific letter.
Yeah, that was terrific. Yeah, for sure. So unusual traits that some of these dogs had. August, or Augie the dachshund, would beg for macadamia nuts?
Yes, he was probably the favorite of the grandchildren. My brothers and I loved to get Augie to sit under the piano on a Thanksgiving holiday, and he would howl at certain notes that were being played under the grand piano. But he would sit up on his hind quarters at great length, literally, for a macadamia nut, and so
that
we would do
funny.
That. He was also a terrific swimmer, and so we would take him down to the shore in the summertime, and you wouldn't think a dachshund would be a great swimmer, but their legs are so short, but his tail would go in circles like a propeller, and he could really move through the water, which we thought was fascinating.
Kind of fun to watch.
Yeah.
All right, so your grandfather's first dog was a collie named Mac.
Yes, the collie, he writes in that essay he was afraid to have another collie because the first one was so dear to his heart, and it was a dog that was sent to him by his sister in a crate from Washington, D.C., I think, to New York, Mount Vernon, New York, where he was born and raised. He speaks of it as arriving at a time when he was sorely in need of a dog. And the collie dog used to follow him to school and escort him home.
And with his chores, which, like Mac, who went along with your grandfather as he did his chores, you had similar experiences with Maggie,
yes,
who was a mutt.
Yes.
Tell us the story of Mrs. Treacher.
Yes, Maggie was she was a collie beagle mix that my grandfather had rescued. It would be called a rescue dog today, although it wasn't called that then. And my family ended up adopting Maggie because she was so exuberant she would jump on my grandmother, who by that time had skin ailments and couldn't have such a jumpy little dog around. So Maggie came to our house, and I was 10 or so, I think, and was raising white Peking ducks. And the mother duck, Mrs. Treacher, the male was Arthur Treacher, named for, of course, the TV personality, whom I knew from the Merv Griffin show. The female duck died in a hit-and-run accident, and so Arthur Treacher went back and forth. And ultimately, my grandfather had to bring a broody hen over to incubate the duck eggs that we had started and hatch the little ducklings. And, of course, ducklings will imprint on the first thing that they see, and that was Maggie, our collie beagle. And so as the ducklings got older, and, of course, the hen had to go back to the barn because she became quite neurotic at these ducklings
ducks,
that wanted to jump in the pond. So the ducks would grab onto Maggie's fur and coat, and a couple of them got so they could actually climb up on her back and hang on to the ruff of her neck. And Maggie, being so docile, would just take them down to the pond and wait patiently while they jumped off and know that they would hop into the water.
Now, and you did a previous book, it's Words of E.B. White, Quotations from America's Most Companionable of Writers. And one of the things that you talk about in that book is your grandfather really loved sailing and dogs. So why did you choose dogs? Did he not write enough about sailing?
That's interesting. People have asked me, is there going to be an E.B. White on boats?
Yeah.
I tend not to write about boats or work in that category myself because my father and my brother and my husband and my sons are all in the boat building business in Maine, have terrific boatyards, and all love sailing. So I think that's kind of their slice
turf
of the pie.
Yeah.
And certainly dogs are a personal favorite of mine, and we've had many favorite dogs in our life. So this was a natural one and a fun one because the dog essays are so funny and quirky.
So what do you remember about your grandfather's relationships with his dogs?
Well, I think, I didn't know the early dogs, of course, because I wasn't around then. So the first one I really remember is Augie, the little dachshund that I spoke of earlier that swam so beautifully and begged for macadamia nuts. But I also remember Maggie when we came to adopt and many of the little terriers who were neurotic,
yeah,
let's
that's
say.
That's a good way to say it. Yeah.
Many of them. My grandfather said he often would adopt a dog and then they would turn over all their troubles to him. And they certainly did. And some of them came with a whole parcel of them. He, as I said, tended to choose the underdogs, the what would be called rescue dogs today. And some of them came with all sorts of foibles and quirks.
He had a big heart.
He did.
Yeah.
He did.
Do you want to read something for us from the book?
Sure. One of the pieces I love to read, and I'll just do the first and last paragraph of it for time reasons, but it was originally published as part of One Man's Meat, which was the collection of essays that he put together when he was first moving to Maine in the late 30s. And this particular one is about dog training, and it's really about the dog training manuals of today. And it was written in 1940. So this is the first paragraph. Dog training. There is a book out called Dog Training Made Easy, and it was sent to me the other day by the publisher, who rightly guessed that it would catch my eye. I like to read books on dog training. Being the owner of dachshunds, to me, a book on dog discipline becomes a volume of inspired humor. Every sentence is a riot. Someday, if I ever get a chance, I shall write a book or warning on the character and temperament of the dachshund and why he can't be trained and shouldn't be. I would rather train a striped zebra to balance an Indian club than induce a dachshund to heed my slightest command. For a number of years past, I have been agreeably encumbered by a very large and dissolute dachshund named Fred. Of all the dogs whom I have served, I've never known one who understood so much of what I say or held it in such deep contempt. When I address Fred, I never have to raise either my voice or my hopes. He even disobeys me when I instruct him in something that he wants to do, and when I answer his peremptory scratch at the door and hold the door open for him to walk through, he stops in the middle to light a cigarette just to hold me up. So that's the first paragraph, and it goes on beautifully. But the last paragraph is about E.B. White's first dog, the collie dog named Mac, and he writes, A really companionable and indispensable dog is an accident of nature. You can't get it by breeding for it, and you can't buy it with money. It just happens along. Out of the vast sea of assorted dogs that I have had dealings with, by far the noblest, the best, and the most important was the first, the one my sister sent me in a crate. He was an old-style collie, beautifully marked, with a blunt nose and great natural gentleness and intelligence. When I got him, he was what I badly needed. I think probably all the other dogs of mine have been just a groping toward that old dream. I've never dared get another collie for fear the comparison would be too uncomfortable. I can still see my first dog and all the moods and mutations that memory has filed him away in, but I think of him oftenest as he used to be, right after breakfast on the back porch, listlessly eating up a dish of petrified oatmeal rather than hurt my feelings. For 6 years, he met me at the same place after school and convoyed me home, a service he thought up himself. A boy doesn't forget that sort of association. It is a monstrous trick of fate that now, settled in the country and with sheep to take care of, I am obliged to do my shepherding with the grotesque and sometimes underhanded assistance of two dachshunds and a wire-haired fox terrier.
That's beautiful. We're talking with Martha White. Her book, E.B. White on Dogs, a book she compiled from her grandfather's essays, poems, letters, and sketches on dogs. One of the photos that I really like in the book is of Joel White, your dad, about 10, driving the hay truck with his dog Raffles.
Yes.
Tell us about where Raffles got his name.
Well, Raffles, of course, was won in a raffle. My grandfather brought him home in his pocket after winning him in a raffle and gave him to my father, who was at the perfect age for I think it was my father's first dog. And there's also a great photograph of my father training Raffles to pull a berry cart down the road.
Yeah. So you probably, I'm thinking you had a lot of fun putting this together, the fact you're a dog person and, you know, but I can only imagine there had to be loads of photos and loads of material to choose from. So how did you go about editing this book?
Yeah, it started with the quotations book, In the Words of E.B. White. I was putting that together for Cornell University Press, and the section on dogs kept getting quite long. And at first I thought, well, it's just my own predisposition for dogs, and I need to curtail this. And so I started slipping the various pieces in a manila folder, and I thought, well, I'll just go back, you know, at the end and pick out the best of the best and put them in the quotations book. But then by the end of the project, I realized that there really were a lot of them. A lot of them had been uncollected because they were short notes and comment pieces, mm-hmm. or sketches or illustrations, and of course the photographs. And so it occurred to me afterwards, this would make a terrific book. And I'm always looking for the segue between the children's books and the adult essays, because I think a lot of people today may only know my grandfather for Charlotte's Web or Stuart mm-hmm. Little or Trumpet of the Swan. And I'm always looking for ways to say, well, you know, have you read One Man's Meat, or have you right. have you looked at these essays?
Or Shrunk in White on the Elements of Style.
Shrunk in White, yes. yes.
Now, growing up with your grandfather, you didn't realize what a beloved writer he was, right?
I mean, no, not until I went away to high school. I mean, I knew he was a writer. Both my grandparents had their own offices across the hall from each other, and sometimes it sounded like a typing contest to see who was going to put out more letters from the typewriters. But I wasn't aware of how highly regarded he was by other people until I left Maine myself, mm-hmm. And then people started to ask me about him. And at first, I was a little annoyed by it. People would say, oh, what was it like to grow up with E.B. White? And I'd say, well, what was your grandfather like? Mm-hmm. Because to me, he was the grandfather that showed us the barn and took us to the shore, and, you know, like anybody's
right.
grandfather.
Exactly.
It was a fortunate way for me to come to know that, I think.
There's another little short one that I loved, Card of Thanks.
Yes.
A spaniel's ears hang low, hang low. They mop the sidewalks as they go. Instead of burrs and beggar's lice, they pick up things not half so nice. Spaniels deserve our special thanks for mopping floors in shops and banks. Resourceful, energetic, keen, they keep the city
nice and clean. Spaniels should be exempt from tax and be supplied with Johnson's wax.
Right. There are a number of poems in the book, all of them funny, I think, and many of them about city dogs, walking city dogs, for instance. And my grandfather, he really fancied himself a poet. He would love to have been primarily known as a poet, and of course he wasn't. He did publish a book of poems and sketches, but that was really a minor part of his career as far as other people were concerned.
Yeah.
But he loved to do the poems.
He really loved Maine as well, and was such a keen observer of the world around him, not only nature but everything. I mean, he just had this really keen sense of observing the world.
Yes, yes. I think the thing that I notice most in rereading all of his works, which I've done two or three times now in the book projects, is how adept he was at retaining that sense of wonder. Mm-hmm. He really kept that almost childish curiosity and observation, very acute observation, mm-hmm. and keen respect for all creatures. It's a wonderful thing.
Rereading his works and being so involved in it, has it brought you, maybe closer, but give you other insights to your grandfather that you may not have known before or realized?
Certainly, I find pieces that I hadn't noticed before, and that was true in this book, finding so many of the small sketches on dogs that many of them I hadn't seen. But I'm not sure I would say that they were surprises. You know, mm-hmm. there weren't pieces where I thought, oh, that's odd. I wouldn't have imagined that. I think he was a very plain-spoken man, and pretty much what you see is what you get.
Yeah.
There weren't any secrets or hidden corners.
But what a great feeling, though, to be so close to this work and going through that. I would imagine it brings back a lot of memories for
it
you.
It certainly does, yeah. Yes. And, of course, there's so much family in it.
Right.
I mean, being able to see my father as a young boy and his love of the dogs as well, and to see how the love of boats came along. Mm. I mean, my grandfather was he wasn't a great sailor, but he was an avid sailor, and you can certainly see in reading through his early works how my father might have grown up loving boats, and then his children as well. So that's very fun from a family point of view.
Do you want to read another piece for us?
Sure. Let's see. Maybe I'll read one of the dog show pieces. There are a couple of short pieces about going to the dog shows, and in that day they were in Madison Square Garden in New York City, and one of the things that the New Yorker really did right with my grandfather is they allowed him to leave the desk and walk out into the city and find his subject matter,
yeah.
and the dog shows were a favorite. So there are two pieces in here. The first one is called Dog Show, A New Showmanship, and it was written in 1935 as a talk of the town notes and comment piece. Next year, when dog show time comes around, we would like to see a wholly new brand of showmanship introduced into the garden. We were horribly bored by the judging last week, all that business of standing around a ring hour after hour, brushing a dog's tail the wrong way, and jacking his tail up with the palm of your hand. Who cares, anyway? Only a handful of fanciers know about a dog's points, and besides, conformation and ring manners are piffling qualities in a dog, revealing little about the animal's character, exploits, or temper. A dog should be made to work for his ribbon, each breed in his own wise. Pointers should have to point. Shepherds should be required to herd a band of sheep from the east goal to the west goal. Poodles should be required to jump through a paper hoop, not just follow Mrs. Sherman Hoyt around the ring. English bull terriers should be made to count up to 10. Retrievers retrieve rubber ducks. Scotties chew up old shoes. Greyhounds should be put over the high hurdles. Sled dogs should race with a little antitoxin, while St. Bernards carry brandy to anyone in the audience who feels weak, preferably us. Beagles would jolly well have to beagle or shut up. How about it, dogs? Are you dogs or mice? And then let me just quickly read the second one. It's about the obedience contest. And this one has the last line of it is perhaps my favorite line in the book. Dog Show Obedience Contest. It was written in 1947. Friday, 14 February. last night to Madison Square Garden to watch the obedience contest in the dog show, and it resulted in a 15-0 victory for obedience, the Boston Terrier abstaining. It did not seem to me, though, that this dog's abstention indicated a lack of cooperation or even a contempt for obedience, but simply that the Boston Terrier's mind was on other matters, which from my own experience is where a Boston Terrier's mind is more than 90% of the time. The dog show is the only place I know of where you can watch a lady go down on her knees in public to show off the good points of a dog, thus obliterating her own.
I know, I read that. That was funny.
I think we've all seen that moment in the Westminster dog shows or others.
The other photo that really stands out in the book to me is Fred on his rope.
Yes.
Which keeps him from chasing porcupines?
Yes, he was constantly, as my grandfather put it, trying to subdue a porcupine, which, of course, he failed at miserably to his own detriment many times, and my grandfather got tired of pulling the quills out.
Yeah.
So he was often on a tether, much to his dismay.
You wonder what goes through that dog's head that he wants to chase after a porcupine.
After
you got those quills once, wouldn't you have learned a lesson?
Yeah, no.
Exactly. There's another great piece from The New Yorker from 1949, Talk of the Town, Architects and Dachshunds.
Yes.
That's a great piece. To read a little bit of that.
This is about dachshunds descending stairs in old New England households, which was a favorite moment for my brothers and I to witness. There were two sets of stairs in the house, and one of our favorite things to do was to dash toward the steeper set from the upstairs and go down. And of course, the dachshunds had learned that they couldn't navigate that step, so they would come following you down the hallway and then abruptly turn and find the other set of stairs, and we would race to the bottom to see who would get there first.
That's
the dogs or us. So this is from Architects and Dachshunds from 1949. Serious consideration should be given by architects to the problems of people who own dachshunds. The modern boys, the Wright, the Gropiuses, the Neutras, are full of startling ideas about functional design. But it is one thing to design a house around a person, and it is something else again to design a house around a dachshund. Chief of the problems is the matter of stairs. Here, proportion is everything. An English setter takes a flight of stairs in his stride, literally in his stride, one paw after another. He merely crouches slightly and glides up or down. A dachshund, because of his low center of gravity, which in some individuals is simply a center of frivolity, is incapable of going up and down stairs one paw after another. He or she must tackle stairs in a series of bold, sometimes hysterical leaps, the two forepaws and the two hind paws operating in pairs. The ascent of a dachshund is a sort of conniption. It requires considerable driving power, most of it supplied by the hind legs. The descent, far more difficult and in some instances disastrous, is a series of suicidal leaps with the dog in imminent danger of nosing over. If you have never studied the descent of a dachshund, perhaps a brief description will help. The animal first gets himself down into correct launching position, forepaws down one step, hind paws poised at brink of takeoff. If he is an elderly dog, he remains in launching position for several minutes, reviewing the situation and making side remarks. Having determined to go, he throws himself outward with just enough force to drop him onto the next step down, still in the launching position. Obviously, he must neither overshoot nor undershoot, and he must relaunch himself the very instant he makes contact. That is, he must continue to bounce, legs tensed and in pairs, one step at a time, till he reaches the bottom. A dachshund with long toenails descending in an uncarpeted staircase makes a sound unlike any other in nature. And I'll stop there. It goes on. But it's a great piece of description.
It really is. Yeah. That kind of, you know, what inspires some of his writings is a lot of fun. He's such a beloved writer. You must really have a good time when you go around on these book tours. It's very fun.
Yeah. It's easy to get a laugh in the readings. Dog lovers and E.B. White lovers alike are there with great affection, and it's great.
Yeah. Did you have to leave much out because he wrote so much on dogs? I mean, was it tough to figure out what to put in and what to take out of the book, or no?
A little bit. There was certainly much more material than we put in, and a couple of the pieces we put in are only peripherally about dogs, but we thought to include them because they were so great in other ways. Many of the choices were obvious choices because they're so funny. But some of the shorter letters, there could have been many others.
Yeah. He had such a great way with words, as we know, and you know, connecting with nature and sharing that with us. But he really didn't like to give speeches and rarely gave interviews, right?
No, that's right. He was not a public persona. He didn't think writers should be celebrities, and he really was physically incapable of standing before a podium, there were a couple of occasions where he tried to accept awards or prizes or an honorary degree from a university, but it was generally a miserable experience for all, and he avoided it. We often paraphrase my uncle, who at my grandfather's memorial service said famously, "If E.B. White could have been here today, he wouldn't have been here." And that's certainly true of the readings I do. I sometimes start a reading by saying the same thing.
Also, I imagine you must feel pretty rewarded when you're able to introduce new, younger readers to E.B. White's work.
Yes, yes. It's great fun, particularly to find somebody who only knows Charlotte's Web and say, "Oh, you've got to read about these dogs," or "You've got to read One Man's Meat," or some of the other pieces.
Yeah. I have to say, he holds a special place for me because Charlotte's Web was the first book. I mean, you know, as a kid, there's that first thing that just really captures you, that makes you a reader, that you go, "Oh my God, this is what reading's about." That was the book for me.
My own favorite was Stuart Little, and so I'm always interested to hear who likes which for me it was the small mouse, who had many of the same characteristics as my grandfather. He also loved sailing, for instance.
The book is E.B. White on Dogs, edited by Martha White. Martha, thanks so much for coming in and talking with us. We always love to visit with you.
Thanks for having me, Mindy.